Green Sense Radio is brought to you by Green Sense Farms. We're changing the world with sustainable indoor vertical farming, growing more with less. Our leafy greens are sold live, so they burst with flavor. Visit greensensefarms.com and watch us grow.
Welcome to Green Sense, a weekly look at the people, policies, and innovations that are changing our world. Here's Robert Colangelo.
Hey, that's me. Welcome to Green Sense. Bob Kessler, executive producer, will tell us more about who we're going to meet this week.
Our old friend Tom Appel of Consumer Guide Automotive has some news about Volkswagen and electric vehicles. Also, electric vehicle sales overall, so he'll tip us off there. You know, Robert, to be a wetland, it doesn't actually have to be wet.
That seems counterintuitive.
We will be meeting someone from the Wetlands Initiative who will explain all of that and tell us why it's very important to be looking after wetlands.
All coming up on this edition of Green Sense. We kick off this edition of Green Sense with some green automotive news from Tom Appel, publisher of Consumer Guide Automotive. Tom, welcome back to Green Sense.
Thanks for having me.
And, you know, one of the things that makes summer enjoyable is driving cars. And Volkswagen has the new VW ID. Buzz coming out, which is making old new again. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, Volkswagen is launching a series of vehicles, and we've actually spoken about this architecture. It's Volkswagen's MEB architecture, which will underpin a number of different electric models, and the Buzz, B-U-Z-Z, is one of those models. It should be the third or fourth vehicle that Volkswagen launches that is a pure electric vehicle on this architecture. But the beautiful thing about the Buzz is how much it looks like the classic microbus, which is actually a fantastically simple and basic shape that makes for really great interior utility. So that'll be a fun one to watch. We're watching for the ID.3. That will be the first electric vehicle, pure electric vehicle, that Volkswagen launches of its new family of cars, and that comes out this fall.
And I bring up the Buzz because it looks like it's surf ready, and it's ready for the summer and the beach. As you said, it looks it's a modern version of the old VW bus, and it's electrified. So tell us a little bit, what kind of range are they anticipating?
Well, it depends on which vehicle it is, but the MEB architecture should host batteries as large as 90 kilowatt hours. So in a vehicle like the Buzz, which is really sort of a minivan, we should probably be looking range right around 200 miles in its most effective state.
Tom, what do you think that'll be priced at?
That's a good question. I suspect that before we talk about any sort of federal tax credits, probably in the high 30s, maybe low 40s.
Well, that's pretty affordable because it looks like it'll hold six people.
Yeah, it should do that very well. It should be a three-row vehicle, should hold six, seven people. And it's the kind of fun thing that I think that'll help draw people's attention to electric vehicles.
So you wanted to follow up a little bit in our last discussion on VW. What kind of an update do you have there?
Yeah, we had a conversation about Volkswagen's very bold plans to build a very large number of electric vehicles. We talked about the MEB architecture, and there's a lot of buzz around that particular platform that Volkswagen is working on. And Volkswagen's grand plan to not only build vehicles for itself, but to share and sell this architecture to other manufacturers. This was, of course, to help them achieve economy of scale. Well, a first customer has actually appeared. It's looking as Volkswagen and Ford have signed a cooperative deal on a number of programs, and one of those will involve Ford purchasing MEB architecture for its own electric vehicle for sale in Western Europe. Ford plans to begin selling a vehicle as early as 2025 and purchasing as many as 100,000 of these platforms a year for 6 years under the arrangement.
How unique is that in the auto industry to have competing companies, share and purchase technologies from each other?
It's not unique, but it is rare that it's this large. And often you'll find a manufacturer in a certain market looking to plug a hole in its lineup, and they will borrow a car from someone else and sell it as their own. That's reasonably common, but on scales as large as 600,000 units, you usually don't see something like this.
Do you see other auto manufacturers following Ford's lead?
Probably. I think that Volkswagen, especially because Volkswagen will have the expertise to sell cars that are Western Europe certified and obviously ready for sale. I think other manufacturers may do the same thing. We'll see. But the Ford thing is very interesting, and it kind of breaks down the dam in terms of someone purchasing this Volkswagen architecture, someone not Volkswagen using this architecture.
You had another story you wanted to update us on.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about a little bit about EV sales through the first half of the year. They're interesting, but they're also a little bit depressing if you look into the numbers. So for the month of June, for example, we have EV sales of 37,800 units. Now, when we talk about EVs, we're talking about plug-in vehicles. That's pure electric vehicles plus plug-in hybrid vehicles. And that's up about 12,000 from the year before. That's the good news. The bad news, sort of, is that almost all of that volume has come from Tesla. The Model 3, which is Tesla's new affordable compact car, is simply dominating the electric vehicle market. Other makers are selling virtually no volume by comparison. If we look at the top five vehicles for the month of June, the Model 3 was first at 21,000 units. Tesla's own Model X was next at just 3,000 units. The Chevy Bolt came in at 1,659 units, the first non-Tesla vehicle, and it sold at just a fraction of the Model 3.
Well, you could cut that data a lot of ways, and without me fully analyzing it, it's hard to make a good assessment. But one may think that could be driven by the economics of the buyers. You know, Tesla's cars are fairly expensive. Is that due to maybe a more economically mobile class being able to buy those?
And that may still be the case. The Model 3 was supposed to be a more affordable vehicle, and it is indeed cheaper than the Model S and Model X that preceded it at Tesla. But it is still expensive in relative terms. I think the average unit going out the door is selling for more than $50,000. Also worth noting, the Tesla Model 3 and the Chevy Bolt, or in fact all Teslas, no longer qualify for the federal tax credit. So these are selling without that incentive, and yet they're among the best-selling vehicles in the class.
So what's your assessment, Tom? Why do you think Tesla's leading the pack and being so dominant and sales on others are so low?
I still think that Tesla is driven by personality and by reputation. I think that the Chevy Bolt, which is a fine vehicle, just indicates the relative lack of interest in the Chevy Bolt. I think indicates still that there's a large relative lack of interest in electric vehicles in the general public. And I think it's good that Tesla can do this. I think Tesla is probably generating the kind of, if you'll forgive the pun, the buzz to get people into electric vehicles. But it's looking like increasingly we're going to see a lot of manufacturers ready to sell electric vehicles to a public that isn't quite ready to buy them.
Or has Tesla paved the way for innovations like the Buzz from VW and the Rivian pickup truck? And it's just going to take a little while to get, you know, more sexy manufacturers into the marketplace.
Well, that's the case, too. That could very well be the case, Robert. That makes a lot of sense. It's also interesting that, like, there's so much interest in Rivian, and they haven't sold product one yet, that perhaps it's going to actually be outsider companies that are able to sell into this segment, which means that we're looking at a really interesting paradigm shift and the possibility of new manufacturers getting into a business that is traditionally very difficult to get into.
Tom, you reported, I think, a couple of weeks ago that overall vehicle sales are down. Can that also have an impact on the EV market?
Yeah, Robert, that's a great point, because generally when sales are down, and they're down relatively significantly, I think we're looking at about 500,000 fewer units for 2018 or 2019. I think that's production. People tend to be a little bit less adventurous when they purchase vehicles as the market tends to decline. There's some sense that the economy isn't as strong as it should be, so people make more conservative buying decisions. And I think it's in a climate like this, to your point, that people might be just a little bit less likely to make a switch from gasoline to EV.
And with the younger generation not owning as much, you've also got that trend overlaying. So, and we've talked about that long-term, as autonomous cars become more steady and popular, that the manufacturing companies are going to be owning them. So there's a lot of things going on in the auto industry that makes that data a little hard to analyze, I would think.
No, you're right. And to your point, you could parse this data 1,000 different ways. My glance is a bit superficial, but ultimately it's still looking like the buying public not quite yet ready to make the leap.
And you bring out a good point of how important your brand is, and Tesla has a brand and a loyal following. So anyways, very interesting data. And as always, our guru of gears enlightens us with information that we don't hear everywhere else. So thanks for joining us, Tom, and we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Sounds good. Thanks.
That's Consumer Guide Automotive publisher Tom Appel. Visit ConsumerGuide.com to read his articles and reviews. This is Robert Colangelo, and you're listening to GreenSense. Visit GreenSenseFarms.com to subscribe to our podcast.
Radio is brought to you by GreenSense Farms. We're changing the world with our sustainable indoor vertical farming, growing more with less. Our leafy greens are sold live, so they burst with flavor. Visit GreenSenseFarms.com and watch us grow.
Dedicated to restoring the wetland resources of the Midwest to improve water quality, increase wildlife habitat and biodiversity, also reduce flood damage. It was founded 25 years ago, and we're joined now by CEO Paul Botts. Paul, welcome to GreenSense.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
Paul, did you found the organization?
No, I've been with TWI, as we call it, for about 8 years. Our co-founders, about 25 years ago, were two fellows named Al Pyatt and Donald Hay, and one of them was a conservationist, had worked with the Nature Conservancy and other groups, and the other was an environmental engineer, and that pairing was not accidental. It reflects the organization and the work we do, which is that we do both the earth moving and the ecology. We like to say that we're the folks that break the eggs to make new omelets in terms of wetlands design and restoration.
And that's very unique. A lot of nonprofits don't actually get into the field and do work, and your organization gets a score of 99.46 out of 100 on Charity Navigator.
Well,
that's extremely high.
For that, yes.
what do you attribute such a high score to?
Well, that is Charity Navigator is a combination of the financial and what you might call the good governance sides of a nonprofit. And the financial, of course, is about how efficient you are and how well do you use the donor dollars, and also things like, are you avoiding debt and that sort of good business stuff. And then the good governance is about transparency, about your practices and so forth. And, you know, we're no longer a startup, we like to say. We're 25 years old, so we're not a kid anymore. And you learn a few things along the way. And we have very consciously made some improvements and changes these last 5 or 10 years. And I'm happy to say that's the third or fourth year that we've had the 4-star rating from Charity Navigator.
You're a 0.5% short of 100. So in 2019, yeah. Are you going to get to 100?
Well, I don't know. We are not privy to the formula, of course. They're the third-party evaluator, but we'll take the 99.5.
The average person may know a wetland when they see it, but they may not know how to define it. So how do you define and classify a wetland?
We tend to define wetlands based on not simply the fact that it is wet, which, by the way, doesn't have to be wet all the time. In fact, there are wetlands all around you, probably, as you walk around, either current or historic wetlands. Wetlands can be intermittent. But what really makes it a wetland in our eyes is that the natural communities, so the plants, the animals, the insects that have been there for a long time and have really are organisms that have evolved for a wetland condition. And so actually we now have a fingerprint of sorts that our scientists use. This is fascinating to me as a layperson. I didn't know this till I joined the Wetlands Initiative, that when a place, a spot, has been a wetland for a long time, let's say centuries or millennia, it leaves behind a very clear fingerprint, we now know, in the soil, which is the soil chemistry. The organics that grow there and die there, so that's the plants, animals, insects, over time change the soil chemistry in certain ways, and it becomes what is now technically known as hydric soils. And so a spot, a field, a bottom of a hillside, a small site, a big site, which was wetland for a very long time, will have these hydric soils which remain in place for years or centuries after it's drained and no longer being treated as a wetland. And that fingerprint is now actually a significant piece in how we identify former wetlands and consider trying to restore it. And I find that fascinating. You can just literally go around if you know what you're looking for and stick a thing in the ground and check the soil chemistry and say, aha, this was a wetland for a long time.
As technology advances, it's amazing how we're able to just get better understanding of things. In maybe a sentence, can you define a wetland?
A wetland is an area which is wet on a regular basis, intermittently or year-round, and which is full of organisms which have adapted for those conditions.
And how threatened are they?
Well, they're very threatened. Now, we work in the Midwest, and in the Midwest, well over 90% of the original wetlands are either gone or seriously disturbed.
90%, so that's significant.
Yeah. Yes, it is. And it varies from state to state, from region to region. So this is a very broad brush statement. But and in Illinois, in fact, it's greater than 90%. And so the Midwest was settled by European people. In the big picture, settled really in a big old rush, if you think about it. That as of, let's say, the American Revolutionary War, there was, you know, almost no settlements of any size or depth here in Illinois in the Midwest. And then people rushed in and settled it. And by the time you get to just 100, 150 years later, there's cities and farms and railroads and everything all over everywhere. And of course, people very busily and very successfully and effectively in that industrial age context drained wetlands. Drained, leveled, ditched, all these things, and got real good at it. And so as we fast forward to today, we have lots of fabulous rich soil in Indiana, Illinois, Iowa, this whole Midwestern states. That's why it's the Great Farm Belt. Many of those soils were created over centuries by wetlands. Wetlands are very good at creating very rich soil. And so this part of why this is such a fabulously successful area of modern human development.
That's a great explanation, and you could see how populations have developed the area and have reduced the amount of wetlands. Why should we care about them?
Well, because they're extraordinarily productive. They're productive for lots of purposes. You can start with the natural purposes. Wetlands are really incubators. They have many species of plants and animals and insects live in wetlands, and in the case of many animals and insects, they might spend part of their life cycles, far more than you'd think. This isn't just the frogs and the turtles that you'd think of as a wetland, and we certainly have plenty of those, and many of those are endangered. But it's actually lots of other species that just spend part of their life cycle in a wetland. The wetlands are extraordinarily productive all over the world. This is part of the whole natural landscape, wetlands are where a lot of things really grow and develop and depend on. For human purposes, wetlands can be extremely productive. For example, whether it's flood control or pollution treatment, wetlands can be very good actually at filtering and breaking down certain kinds of pollution. We're working on some specific constructed wetlands for that purpose on farms, for example, but there's others, examples of that. And wetlands also are very good buffers and sort of absorbers. And in a context of a changing climate, wetlands, if anything, become more important because they are so good at being sponges. They will absorb heavy influxes of water, all this highly variable weather that you hear about and we're all experiencing. Wetlands evolved, developed for that. They're not static. They change. They shrink. They grow naturally. They can do that. They're very flexible. And so in a lot of ways, wetlands are very productive and can be very useful to us if we can have them back and if we can treat them right.
Have there been policy changes in the last 10, 15 years? I know at one time, whenever you destroyed a wetland, you had to create it somewhere else.
Yes.
Has that changed? And talk a little bit about that, where
yeah.
we're at.
Well, so on the one hand, we often say in our offices, and for example, our current, our senior staff engineer these days, who is very experienced with wetlands permitting and mitigation banking and things like that, we do a little bit sigh because the popular impression is that there was a time when if you found a wetland, maybe on your property or whatever it was, that it was sort of like suddenly you couldn't touch it and magically the wetlands police or something would swoop in and no touch, that's it, done. It's, you know, that actually has never really been 100% true. There is truth to it. It is harder to develop or drain a wetlands today than it used to be. But it is not as if it's suddenly, you know, something that you just have to stop and that's it. It's not all or nothing, and it never has been. There have been definitely some legal and policy changes that have shifted back and forth on this front in the courts, actually, in recent years, more than in Congress or state legislatures. This is one of those subjects in which the legislatures have really gone kind of dormant and mostly just argue about it, and the courts have been forced to make various decisions, which get pretty technical and geeky. It kind of swings around. The bottom line is that while it's harder to drain a wetland and build on it than it used to be, it is absolutely possible. And the idea that you have to replace a wetland that you've drained with equal or more wetlands elsewhere is true in theory, but not necessarily honored in the breach, as they used to say. And, you know, I got to say, the law and everything on this is a big old mess. It might be a fair way to sum it all up these days.
Well, we met several weeks ago at a water resiliency event, and we talked about voluntary citizen conservation, which is a good segue from this topic. If the government's not enforcing laws or policies are flip-flopping and changing between administrations, then it's time for the citizens to step up. So for the audience, how do you define voluntary citizen conservation, and why is it critical today?
Well, it's critical. It's both critical and a whole lot of fun. And so
that's always good.
That is good. And so what we mean by that is that starting, I'm going to speak very loosely and say a couple of generations ago, and I'm not going to define that. Those of us old enough don't want to ever define that. But so let's say it's roughly in the 80s, thereabouts, and here in the Chicago area where I'm sitting, there was a group of people who started recruiting volunteers, and they, you know, led by a couple of professional ecologists who said, look, we're trying to restore. In this case, it started with things like prairie and oak savanna. And they said, we need more hands, and we can't possibly hire, we couldn't afford to hire, and we can't hire all the people we need to do this. We think we're figuring out how to do this to restore former prairie and oak savanna, which have their own sort of natural fingerprints. And they said, gosh, we need people. And people started wanting to come, and people started wanting to come on a regular basis. So like every weekend during the growing season, they'd come out and they'd first be clearing the invasives and then helping to find and or even plant the native plants and bring back the original natural communities. And this was sort of experimental at first, but it started to work. And they started learning things that you've probably heard about prescribed fire, which turns out to be very important to many natural communities, and including some that are wetlands part of the time. So that's sort of non-intuitive. And that became very successful and went through a couple of iterations and some growth spurts. And now, actually, organizations like ours, we use volunteers on a regular basis for systems that are wetland at least part of the time. One of the things about wetlands and other systems, prairies, oak savannas, even woodlands, they're not really separate. It's one of the things we always say. We, the Wetlands Initiative, we're involved with prairies. We're involved with other things because wetlands and nature are all threaded together. There are big, giant wetlands, you know, the Everglades or something, but there's actually far more small threaded wetlands.
In summary, can you sort of wrap that up as far as what is that volunteer conservation?
So you can, as a person in an area like the Chicago area, you can decide to get involved. You don't have to know anything to start with. And you can be going out to sites every weekend or as often as you'd like and helping the professionals restore original, beautiful, natural systems like wetlands and prairie that used to exist and could exist with effort. And people find it very rewarding. Some of them then get really into it and get trained and become the lead stewards. And it's a whole movement. Thousands and thousands of people are doing it all over the Midwest now, actually.
Well, Paul, thanks for joining us on GreenSense, and we wish you the best of luck with your efforts, and we hope that you get that extra half point this year and make it to 100% on charity.
Well, we'll do our very best. Thank you so much.
That's Wetlands Initiative CEO Paul Botts joining us on GreenSense. Visit their website at wetlands-initiative.org. I'm Robert Colangelo, and this is GreenSense. Visit our website at greensensefarms.com. We hope we provided you with some stimulating information that caused you to look at sustainability a little differently this week. Visit greensensefarms.com to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. Thanks for listening to this edition of GreenSense. Stay fresh, keep innovating, because when you're green, you grow.
GreenSense Radio is brought to you by GreenSense Farms. We're changing the world with sustainable indoor vertical farming, growing more with less. Our leafy greens are sold live, so they burst with flavor. Visit greensensefarms.com and watch us grow.
GreenSense is recorded in the Duneland ecosystem on the eastern shores of Lake Michigan. The program is copyright GreenSense Farms, all rights reserved.